Hello, everybody. It's Lucas Rockwood, and thanks so much for joining us. We have a very special recording today, and I'm very proud to be joined by Gabrielle Reyes and Robert Scanlon from Australia. Gabrielle is best known as the Hot Yoga Doctor, and she's done a lot of work with Hot Yoga and Bikram Yoga, and we're going to be talking about the healing power of yoga today, and also the flip side, which are injuries. And we'll probably touch on a bunch of other Hot Yoga-related issues as well. So for those of you who don't know, Gabrielle lives in Australia with her lovely family where she teaches hot yoga and runs a number of online teaching programs specifically for hot yoga students. So the hot yoga world is very, very big and very, very, it's, you know, one of the fastest growing communities in the world, in the yoga world. And what's really interesting about Gabrielle's work is she's provided an online space where people can get answers and ask questions and connect. And we met a couple years ago, and we've been chatting and sharing ideas and working together ever since. So you probably already know about Gabrielle's home study course, but if you don't, you can learn more at www.hotyogadoctor.com. And that's where you'll see all the information about her home study course. And she's also got an ongoing members forum, and this is where you can ask questions and interact with other students. And there's actually quite a few teachers there as well. So with all that stuff out of the way, we'll jump right in. Gabrielle and Robert, are you there?
Yes, we are.
Yes, hi. Hi, Lucas.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. So I have a bunch of different questions for you today, and maybe we'll just jump right in if that's okay with you.
Of course.
Great. So, you know, of all the things that you're known for, one of, you know, your reputation that people talk about a lot is your precision alignment, specifically with hot yoga. And I know myself, I'm generally pretty weak in that area, and a lot of students have a huge interest in precision alignment. So I wonder if you could just, you know, everybody in the yoga community has their own passion and their own specialty, and I wonder if you could tell us how you became interested in precision alignment and, you know, how that influences your teaching and your practice and your approach.
Oh, thanks very much, Lucas. Yes, I am impassioned by that. And I guess it really gets driven by my own results and benefits from having started hot yoga in the first place and having had so many wonderful benefits and through my own path of self-discovery and finding that tiny little movements can make the hugest difference to the way you feel and the way that you benefit in the long run. I guess I just wanted to share that with everybody, and that's what I do from day to day.
Yeah, I guess the question is, like, you know, if we have two students in class and they're practicing next to each other, and we have one who's been trained in precision alignment and specific alignment for yoga poses, and we have another student who isn't, you know, how is their experience going to be different, and what, you know, what kind of benefits can the person who is trained, what kind of benefits are they going to see? You know, what is the difference? Is it really worth spending our time on, and what kind of things are, you know, what kind of things can students notice?
That's a great question. Well, firstly, they're going to have a lot less struggle in their practice. They're going to find that the positions that they can get themselves in are much more awakening for the body. They can breathe more continuously and more effectively because their body's going to be creating the right kind of movements. And if you have actually set your body up to create the right tractions with the right alignment, with the right micro adjustments, you'll actually be able to surrender to the pose more and work on the things that really matter. And then when you work on the things that matter, you're not wasting a lot of energy. You're getting into the pose and you're getting the benefits quicker, even through your setup, through the pose, and on the way out of the pose again. As opposed to the person who's not very aware, they might be stumbling through a little bit more, doing what they think might be correct, and really not setting up the pose the way that they could benefit from the most. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it almost seems like you're saying, you know, if you spend the time to set up a pose properly, you know, it has a cascading effect or a domino effect, and the benefits and your enjoyment and your comfort and all this is going to compound, whereas if you kind of sloppily go into a pose, those effects will compound as well. Am I understanding that right?
Yes, you are. And I also think it's got something to do with the way we like to compartmentalize things and compartmentalize our learning. So, for example, if you go to a class with okay, 26 poses and 2 breathing exercises or whatever you do, if you go in there sloppily or you don't set it up properly, then you're going to be doing a set of 26 plus 2 exercises punctuated by a few rests in between. But if you learn proper alignment and you learn setup and you learn how to get out, then you can actually start to treat your entire yoga class as your yoga, and it's from the moment you start to the moment you finish, and you have much more of a cohesive effect, much more benefits that filter through your life because you've got the discipline, the focus, and the attention where you need it, when you need it.
That's great. You know, I think it kind of leads right into my next question, which is, it's kind of, well, topic of discussion anyway. It's this idea that, you know, people do get hurt in yoga, and it's a reality, and yoga teachers like to pretend it doesn't happen, and they like to, you know, so you're never going to get hurt. And of course, compared to any other activity, whether we're talking about jogging or tennis or rock climbing, I mean, injuries are very, very low, but they do happen. I mean, I always call myself like the crash test dummy of yoga, because I just try any old pose and I have bruises. And at some point, you know, some part of my body is usually always hurting. And, you know, only myself to blame for this. But a lot of my students are a lot more cautious and a lot more careful, but they still do get injuries. And maybe it's a hamstring is a common thing. Maybe it's a ping in their knee or a lower back squish or even some weird things like wrists and elbows. And I wonder, you know, what do you think causes injuries in yoga, and how can people prevent them? Or, you know, maybe they can't prevent them altogether, but how can they minimize them?
All right, there's a lot of stuff in there. Let me see if I can approach it one at a time. So the first bit was really the fact that people do get injured. Now, I know it really is a shame that they do get injured, but it can often be about ego and an atmosphere of competition. But that's not all that it's about. It's also about not being acquainted with your own body. Now, I know you've done a lot of Ashtanga and Vinyasa flow classes, and I know that you would probably know that if you don't hold your core in and you try some of those jump-through movements, then you can actually hurt yourself too if you're not holding your core in properly and using your pelvic floor. So there is an aspect of simply not understanding how to activate your core muscles and being more familiar with your own body. And I actually had a conversation with Robert the other day, and he gave me a really great example. Can you remember what that was about, Robert? The car.
I'm always dumbing things down to the rev head level. So, you know, I mean, everybody, at some point, most people learn to drive a car and pretty much, you know, go on autopilot, don't do it consciously, they do it unconsciously. And what we're referring to here is a little bit like somebody driving a car downhill in, say, top gear or fourth gear, and then wanting to slow down. And instead of using the brake or taking the foot off the accelerator, they're trying to jam the gear stick into first gear just to slow down. And most of us would never dream of doing that with a car because we've become accustomed to how it works. But interesting enough, I don't think the same time and care is taken in yoga with people understanding how their body works in order to make the pose function. And that's why they can get injured.
You know, it's a really interesting analogy, the car analogy, because that is exactly my situation with cars. Like, I don't drive. I know how to drive, but, you know, in the past 10 years, I probably drive once every 2 years, literally. I rent a car somewhere. So, but every time I get behind the wheel, I can drive. And, you know, people in the car, I tell them I'm really not a good driver. I shouldn't be driving. And they say, no, you're a fine driver. Go ahead and drive. And they don't understand that just because I'm going down the road and I haven't crashed yet doesn't mean I'm not going to crash, you know? And even though it sort of feels like second nature, it's really not. And I think sort of coming, you know, drawing that back to the yoga room, I think a lot of people rock up to these yoga classes and they start doing these moves, which when you look at them, they really do look easy. They really do look simple. And, you know, if we're going to actually compare apples to apples, this is natural range of motion that we've lost. But people haven't done it, just like me. I haven't driven much. They really haven't done these movements, whether it's bending backwards or even bending forwards or getting into their hips or their shoulders or whatever it is. But they have this sort of youthful confidence like I do with driving, where they can get behind the wheel and do it. But, you know, the chances of me crashing are so high and the chances of them getting injured are so high. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Just to me, yeah.
Well, we're digressing now, so I'm going to take us right back on track. And so I think the other aspect that we're going to talk about with injury is that of ego and competition. Because fortunately for some people, it's because of the yoga that they actually learn to temper those aspects of their character or personality and learn to be in their bodies and to respond to the need and respect their abilities without judgment or comparison. But it's that comparison that can get people into trouble in the room. It could be comparison with oneself or comparison with others in the room. So hot yoga tends to attract type A personalities who are basically quite achievement oriented. And that's not just the students, but it can also be some teachers. So there can be a climate of force, militancy, coercion, performance, and it's either totally self-generated within the student or because of the teaching style. Now, actually, the person who's actually encouraged the growth of hot yoga himself is also famous for that hardline approach. And of course, in our Western lifestyles, we really focus a lot on attaining goals, and we're often really driven to achieve. So stepping back from the ego is going to help you step back from the possibility of creating injury in your own body, and so is focusing on correct technique, both practical asana technique and meditation technique of following the breath. Now, just briefly, I want to flag that if you think that there is a goal in your pose beyond best alignment, beyond best breathing practice, and doing the best you can to listening to your body, then I really encourage you to take stock and step back from that attachment. You also do have to take stock if your teacher is saying stuff like, your head must be on your knee or the pose doesn't start, because that can cause people to try so hard. Or maybe you've heard the saying, kill yourself, or it should hurt like hell. This frame of mind can really get you into a whole lot of trouble, and not just inside the room. So they take you beyond the point to which you should really be paying attention. And these things become a distraction to the real aim of your practice and misdirects the attention of your unconscious mind. So striving for a goal doesn't really make for, what could I say, symbiotic yoga, because the opportunity cost is that it distracts your attention from what it should be, which is on your breath and alignment. So we generally have really busy minds and it's hard to pay attention to the breath. So a lot of people start to think that with their busy mind that yoga is about paying attention to what their teacher is saying. And that's really great if the person who's teaching you the class is saying the right thing and ecologically directing your conscious and unconscious mind for you to get the best results, to remain safe and to avoid injury. I have a feeling that not everyone's going to agree with me about this, but I guess that really doesn't matter, because I feel very firm about this. My belief that a big cause of injury is scripted, ambiguous, and erroneous directions. So I'm just asking that people be aware of the commands. Just be aware of the commands you let past your mind's gatekeeper. So some of the other causes of injury are that many teachers lack observation skills, and many can't or don't correct their students. And if the instruction's poor, then the student will find it hard to correct themselves. How do you correct yourself if you don't know what you're correcting? And in hot yoga, there's often a culture of not touching or not correcting. And I think, was the last part of your question about prevention, wasn't it, Lucas?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know, again, I don't really know if it's possible to prevent injuries altogether. I mean, you know, the human body is, you know, it's an imperfect machine, and it will, you know, anytime you're going to use it, you're going to get, somebody's going to get hurt. Somebody's going to, if they don't get hurt in the yoga class, they'll slip and fall in the bathroom, you know, on their way out of class. But, you
well, that's
know,
not funny.
I wasn't laughing. You were laughing. Yeah. With that in mind, I just wonder if there's, you know, I think you've covered a lot of this, but just ways people can prevent. And I think maybe the best thing we've heard is this idea of, you know, just making it your own practice. And people get really caught up of doing this perfect pose, when really, you know, the best yoga practitioner in the world is not really that amazing physically. You know, if we look at the grand scheme of things, you know, if you want to look at Cirque du Soleil or even street performers I see here in Barcelona, physically, we're not trying to do amazing feats. So to get obsessed over, you know, having the deepest or the most amazing posture, maybe that's not really where we need to put our focus. And maybe, like you said, just looking to your own self and setting your goals personally, as opposed to comparing yourself in the mirror or to some idea of your teacher or perfection.
Yeah, exactly. Because I was going to say that ultimately, as a student, you have to take responsibility for your own practice. And to an extension of that is that you don't have to do what the teacher says. And I mean that within reason, because obviously you've chosen to attend a certain class, so you're going to follow certain poses. So what I mean by not doing what the teacher says is that you need to take stock and make sure that you stay safe. And you need to take responsibility and understand how the body functions and benchmark it against what should be happening. And, you know, it can be very hard to find that precision or expert information about the series that you're practicing, which was actually my problem at the beginning of practice. So the next thing to do is to choose your yoga teacher and your studio wisely, because if something doesn't gel, you've got to do something about it. So for every studio that's pushy and uses a bullying approach with very little care and attention to thoughtful direction, there are a handful that will encourage you to do your best and coach you to do things right. So I say, vote with your feet, or in the case of us yogis, vote with your asana. So, and then the other point of that was about why people go there, and it's an extension again of taking responsibility. It's about peer group pressure, because peer group pressure is both good and bad, and a lot of people turn up to hot yoga because of the peer group pressure of, you know, of people they respect and love, right? So it might get you to class, and it might get you to believe all the anecdotal stuff around, but be careful of the other beliefs that come along with that for the ride. For example, the yoga fixes everything, or you have to experience pain to get your benefits, or just keep coming and this condition that you have will be cured. So it's really important, as you're saying, take responsibility and do your practice. And finally, I guess it's not just practice that makes perfect, it's perfect practice that makes perfect. So to ground that practice on solid, very good alignment is the way that you're going to get the benefits you're after. Because a mediocre yoga teacher or practice is just going to lead to mediocre benefits and to perhaps injury as well.
Well, great. Maybe we can jump into kind of a next question here, which is sort of this interesting theory that I have that I'm always sharing with hot yoga teachers and kind of getting their input on. And as you know, I started out as a really rabid hot yoga student, and then I moved into Ashtanga yoga for many years. And the approach is quite different in terms of what they focus on, but I sort of found this similarity, and I kind of want to get your input on it. And so in Ashtanga yoga, or in a lot of vinyasa yoga practices, you know, the three fundamentals of asana are breath, bandha, and drishti. So breath in, you know, a vinyasa practice or an Ashtanga practice, you use an ujjayi pranayama breath, which is like a controlled whisper sounding breath through your nose. And then you have bandha, which would be like an internal lock or like a energetic and muscular squeeze of the lower pelvis, a lot more complex than that, but the area below your navel basically. And then drishti is where you look with your eyes. So you have sort of this threefold approach to asana, and those are kind of the fundamentals for the practice. And so I kind of draw the parallel with breath, bandha, and drishti. If you look at hot yoga and sort of the genius of hot yoga and why it's become so popular, this, again, this is just my theory, but is that it's taken those three abstract, difficult practices and made them very simple. So for breath, it's really simple. It's just breathe through your nose. So it simplifies this breathing thing. And then for bandha, rather than trying to find these really subtle energetic locks in your lower pelvis, which for most people take a solid 1 to 3 years to find, there's this simplified thing, which is lock the knee. I don't love that verbiage, but that action of locking your knee inadvertently engages your lower pelvis, usually when done right. And then there's this third thing of drishti, and in vinyasa practices, every pose has a different drishti. Sometimes it's the third eye, sometimes it's the tip of your nose, sometimes it's the tip of your fingers, impossible to remember them all. But in hot yoga classes, it's just look at yourself in the mirror. So, you know, you take these kind of three really subtle, abstract, almost ethereal practices, and you make them into these really visceral, simple practices that people can get, literally understand and get within the first 7 minutes of class. And then you get a practice that's accessible to everyone. And I just kind of wonder what you think about that theory. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about this lock the knee idea as well.
Okay. All right. Well, gosh, you don't believe in asking simple questions. Well, straightforward questions anyway. Okay. I agree. There's an accessibility to hot yoga and Bikram yoga that just makes it pretty much unsurpassed in the way that so many people from all walks of life can just come into a class and enjoy that. I guess I would disagree with you a tiny bit in a couple of these things. Maybe not necessarily the actual principles of them, but maybe how easy they are, if that's
sure.
Okay. So I do appreciate that the breath, yes, breathe through the nose is important. And I think with pranayama breathing that we learn in the hot yoga room, that in fact you are drawing the skill of breathing, which is parallel to that which you learn in Ashtanga yoga. And in fact, the most effective breathing that you can have is the Ujjayi breath. And if you're just breathing through the nose without using the right technique, then, you know, you can get your yoga. You can do it, you can have a satisfying practice, but it can really be much more satisfying when you actually learn how to breathe properly. And I do believe that a lot of people will take more than a few minutes to do that. They might take months and months to learn how to breathe properly, just like you do in an Ashtanga practice. Mm. So yes, breathe through your nose, it's a good way of simplifying it, but it oversimplifies it. Mm. So you know, the next one is, I also agree with the drishti thing, that yes, it's, you get this unparalleled experience of being able to connect with yourself in the mirror. And somehow, when you manage to do that, that actually makes the experience of doing your hot yoga something that becomes very personal and something that you can rely on to create that self-connection when sometimes you get lost in the room by getting distracted by too many other things. So it's a way to bring yourself back in the poses that you can see yourself in the mirror. Too much reliance on that can happen, where people absolutely require the mirror in order to get their meditation or to be able to have a satisfactory practice. So yes, I do believe that the mirrors and the looking at yourself is a fantastic thing to do. Now, you did mention something about the bandhas and the internal lock, which, you know, you really do need that for your life, because it not just jump-throughs in Ashtanga. And you do need that in your yoga room. And I found with my experience of teaching hot yoga, especially this particular series, that there are students that have been able and that are routinely able to get through their entire class without ever really getting an adequate internal lock. And these are the people who continually have problems with their lower back, who aren't able to activate their core. So, and you can't do that in an Ashtanga class, can you?
How do you mean?
You can't get through a class without, you do a jump through without having an internal lock.
That's right. That's right. There are certain things that just won't work. That's a great point. I never thought of it that way, but you're right. There are certain things that just won't work.
So once again, the accessibility of the series actually allows people to, you can actually get through this entire class without having your bulla bunda, right? So I'm not sure that locking the knee is enough, and actually I would think that sucking the stomach in is probably the one that would more closely approximate getting you that stabilization. But actually, you know what? I read something today, and I'm going to read it to you right now because it was in the newspaper. Unbelievable. I copied it because I thought, this is great. Unfortunately, what is often taught or understood is core rigidity rather than core stability. right? Where the large surface trunk muscles are being overtrained and the deep core muscles aren't even working. This leads to bracing yourself while doing the exercises, which is very likely to cause damage. And that was part of a very big article that I found today in the Sydney Morning Herald about Pilates and core exercises. So I thought that was fascinating, given that we're just answering questions about that right now. Okay.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing because, you know, you'll see people who come into a yoga class who have what looks like very strong abdominal strength. You know, you'll see guys, weightlifters and stuff, come in with six-pack abs, and yet they can't do like a side plank pose, which is just the simplest pose in the world, but it does require core stability, like you mentioned. So they have core rigidity, and they have these sort of, you know, really high surface tension of these exterior abdominal muscles, but when it comes to core stability, they can't even support their own body weight in a simple position. So I think that kind of speaks to that same issue. Maybe if we can kind of loop back to this lock the knee idea. And this is, you know, it's something that people are always talking about. We don't need to go into this in great detail, but I just kind of want to get your take on it. Like, is it safe? Does it lead to hyperextension? And is it really the secret key to hot yoga, or is it just one element? Or, you know, what's your take on this?
Well, it is just one element. That's my take on it. Is it safe? Well, you know, locking the knee is really just a euphemism for full engagement of the quadriceps, and what you're trying to do is activate the muscles to draw the kneecap up, which results in the main purpose, which is leg stabilization, which in turn helps you balance, and it also opens up the knee. So the truth is that you can actually lock the knee skeletally rather than just muscularly, which we're talking about here when we talk about lock the knee. And you can, and you know that, oh, you know, when you're standing at a bench or you're standing in the queue for the bank and you lean into one leg, that's locking a leg, isn't it? Yeah, you sure. Lean into a leg and this is the way many people stand habitually. And so they're actually locking their leg. But then, and so when you say lock the knee, a lot of people are dumbfounded when they discover that you actually do something with your muscles. Because you need to draw the knee apart, the joint apart, and you're using the safety of using the muscles to do that. So a lot of people also consider that locking the knee in isolation, because the knee is part of the leg, and the leg starts at the ground, and often the ankle is completely ignored. And this forms a huge part of the alignment and safety of your practice, including providing safety for the knees and even the possibility to keep everything in alignment, because alignment does start from the ground up. So I might talk in a minute about how else you can do that, but I just wanted to address the fact that locking the knee is not hyperextension. Because there are some people who do actually hyperextend their legs, and this means that if you could draw a line from your hip down to your ankle, a vertical line, the line should pass through the knee. But for some people, the knee goes back behind that line, and it bows back in almost a banana shape. That's what you mean, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the big question is, like, if somebody who generally hyperextension tends to be a natural thing, like people have hyperextension or they don't. Like, I have very stable knees. I've never had a problem. But some people, they as soon as they straighten their leg looks like a strung bow, like a bow and arrow. And I wonder, like, for someone like that, is it safe to practice with a locked out knee? Or are they better, you know, what feels like a micro bend in their knee actually makes their leg go straight? And I don't have an answer one way or this now, and I wonder if you have an opinion one way or the other, which is a better way for somebody who naturally hyperextends in their knees, and how to practice that, especially in a hot yoga series.
Great question, because I do believe it also changes from person to person, because I have people asking this question and giving their experience on the forum. Now, just to go back a little bit, with hyperextension usually occurs sometime back in your years of development because of a real imbalance in the way that you've learned how to use the muscles in your legs. And it often shows a stronger quadriceps on the front and weakened or even stretched or flexible hamstrings on the back. So people with hyperextension can find difficulty in balance because the hamstrings are strongly involved in balance, and they've lost the haven't developed the strength in the balance. And sometimes the way that they do balance is by totally hyperextending so that they can stack their joints instead of use their muscles to actually balance. So yes, I've often taught people that they just don't quite lock it. They try to engage some of their muscles so they get space in their knee, but try to keep it straight. And people have found that that really helps. But what really will help is they probably will need some other professional intervention, like going to a gym and working on some machines to get some hamstring strength back and to start to find some balance, understanding that it took years to develop this problem and it actually may take a while to be fixed as well.
Interesting.
What do you say people should do in the room?
I've always taught a microbend as well. It is there is certainly, I find that people tend to develop elbow hyperextension more so than knees. I find that a lot, you know, like I've seen mother daughters in class and both their knees hyperextend. So, and of course I've seen, you know, relatives as well, where both their elbows were hyperextend, but more often than not, it seems like the knees, some people just seem to be structured that way. They seem to be structured in a way where their body naturally sort of rides into their joints. But the elbows are something that people definitely seem to develop, especially through improper yoga practice. Developing hyperextended elbows is very, very common, especially if you're doing, you know, vinyasa and more floor work. But yeah, so I always recommend the same thing is, you know, a micro bend in the knee, get the leg straight as opposed to bending one way or the other, you know.
And I like to now recommend that people do something else to try and create the balance in their leg and maybe get some more strength in their hamstring. Because you asked if locking the knee is really the key to a hot yoga practice. And I don't think it is, because it's just a funny expression that people put a lot of emphasis on. And I think it's because there are certain idioms in this yoga that people use all the time. And lock the knee is one of those.
Sure.
It's a technique and it's important for some poses. It's not important for all of them, of course, but it's important for a lot of them to provide the stability. But it doesn't take precedence over good alignment from the ground up through foot and ankle, as I said before. And you know what? If you're when you're doing a 1 minute one-legged balancing pose, then you're locking your knee really gets your attention then.
Yes, absolutely. Well, speaking of balancing poses, maybe we kind of jump into my next question. And in terms of, you know, one of the things that makes a hot yoga practices unique is there's quite a bit of standing balancing poses, and not just for 5 breaths or 10 seconds, but sometimes for much, much longer. And a lot of people struggle with balance, and my standing balance has never been amazing. I have sort of weird squished up feet, and I know a lot of my students struggle with balancing stuff as well. And I've never had really amazing advice for how to improve your standing balance, except for working on your feet in terms of like toe flexibility and this kind of thing. And I wonder if you have any insights that you might want to share.
All right. Yes, I'd love to. And once again, another great question that I'd like to maybe address with some general technique-based recommendations. Because you know what, the diagnosis could be many-fold in individual cases. You know, everyone's got their own issues, of course. So as you even intimated, good balance starts from the ground up, work on your feet. But you know, balance can be learned. And the theory that I've developed, I've even written about this before, it's not a position, it's a dynamic state of equilibrium. And what that means is you don't aim to balance as an end point in your pose. It's a complex balancing of many systems and the interplay of a huge number of gross and micromuscular movements that occur continually as you move into a pose or even just stand still in a pose. So you may remember what it's like to learn balance in head to knee when you're standing.
Sure.
And even if you think you can't balance well now, you probably waved around a lot more or fell out of it a lot more when you started. You had gross movements from side to side, you're wobbling back to front, and somehow you still stayed upright because even with all those movements, you found the equilibrium by constantly correcting and overcorrecting within a certain envelope of balance, with the result that you stayed upright. And when the system was not balancing and correcting, you fell out, right? So that's how you learned to create balance. And over time, the envelope of movement becomes smaller and smaller and you just move less, and then it becomes finer and finer. So as I said before, and we keep saying, great alignment starts from the ground up, so you have to pay attention to your feet. And when you sink into the ankle, which we also call pronating, which is moving your ankle inward you can feel that you've actually got more stable in your balance, but what you're actually doing is misaligning the foot, the knee, and the hip on that side. So you're locking your bones into place. So there are things that you can do that don't just involve the foot. So now let's break it down a bit more. So of course, I'd recommend the four-corner weighting of your feet by activating feet muscles and good ground connection. And you'd probably agree that you want to lift your toes and spread them and put them back down again and try and shift it around. Is that what you do?
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
And then what I call lifting up through the ankle to avoid the pronation or sinking of your ankle toward the midline. And then you make sure you don't sink into the hip. And you've heard this one before, shift your weight to your balancing leg. You've heard that. And I absolutely believe that you should never say that, because it actually makes people shift their weight and do something funky to their hip and ankle and knee that they actually don't balance properly. Next thing is to move more slowly and more deliberately into the pose to train your body to accept the different stages of the dynamic creation of the balance rather than rushing into a point of balance. So you mentioned, I think it was balancing stick and standing head to knee.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you've got rote movements where you say charge your body forward, then your body's systems don't have time to create the balance and you're just thrown into instability. So what I like to say is go as fast as you can and as slow as you need to create the balance. Then the next thing I would think is important is about controlling your breathing, because that's another huge part of the balance. So about learning balance. So you can take yourself to another standpoint, a philosophical standpoint, and say we look at someone who's balanced and they say, oh, they're calm, they're balanced. And when someone isn't balanced, how do you imagine their breath to be? They might be short of breath, they might have wild or short jerky movements. And now let's take that into your yoga practice. I think the skill of balance happens when the student learns to control their breathing as well. So you may find in longer balancing poses that your breathing has changed, might have sped up a bit. It could be that you need to shift to a deeper, more continuous breath to restore your balance, or you might find that you imbalance and wobble or even fall out of it.
It's an interesting thing, this idea of, you know, we think of balance as stillness, but it's really not. It's just very, very, like you said, very small controlled movements. But sometimes the language of yoga, like we think of tree pose and we imagine a tree stuck still. But if you were to actually take a close look at anyone's foot in tree pose, there's little micro movements happening all the time. So it's really, like you said, it's this dynamic controlled micro movement that is balance. It's just, there is no such thing as just standing completely
exactly still. And then we go back to one of the main foci of Ashtanga, as you mentioned before, which is the drishti. And it really matters where you look. So you have to fix your gaze softly and use a gaze that's suitable for the balancing point for that particular pose. And if you're in standing bow and you turn your head to look at somebody on the side, you're likely to fall over. And if you wanted an example of that right now, you could stand up, you could lock one leg, put the other leg out and lock that one and lift it up to a 45 degree angle and stand there and look at your foot or look beyond your foot and balance. And then why don't you close your eyes and see what happens then? Or open them again and look around the room, literally turn your head and see what you need to do to balance. You start having to negotiate the movement of your arms to be able to keep your balance, and so it's this dynamic thing that's happening that's creating the balance. It's not just that rock solid position that some people think it is.
Well, great. I think that's a lot of things for people to kind of think about and digest in terms of balance and try to find that, you know, controlled stillness, which isn't really stillness, but just really controlling their movements and their practice. Maybe we can kind of jump into kind of a little more technical weird question, which I get a lot, and I have not an amazing answer for, but I'm a big self-practice guy. I've been, ever since I started doing yoga, even when I was going to class all the time, I still had a self-practice. So I've been self-practicing since 2002, roughly. And, I love going to studios and I love taking new classes, but, you know, on your average day, I'm not going to make it to a studio. I just practice on my own. And a lot of hot yoga students are moms, or they're working, or they're busy guys who are traveling, and they can't make it to class as often as they'd like either. And they want to practice at home. Maybe they want to use your home study kit, your DVDs and your book, or maybe they want to use some other class. And how do they recreate the hot yoga room in their house is the question. Like, for example, me, when I was first into hot yoga, I used to have this old tape of Bikram, and it was just this like horrible recording with the same terrible sort of offensive jokes over and over. And I would practice to this thing, but without the heat, you know, there was really something missing. And I have a couple of things that I recommend to people, but I wonder if you have a better way of recreating a hot yoga studio in your house, in your hotel room, this kind of thing.
Well, you know that if you want to practice and you don't have the heat, then it's better to do something than nothing at all. But for those people who really want to set up something at home, it really is a question of physics, Lucas. You can only heat a room to the level that your heater and your level of insulation will allow. So the better the insulation, the quicker you'll heat your room and the hotter your room will stay. Now, I don't have personal experience with using infrared heating, but I know a lot of people on the forum have had that experience and have got some infrared heating at home, and some people experience it at yoga studios. So if you want any information about that, go and have a look in the forum. But I can tell you that if you are going to use conventional heating at home, then I would really recommend that you pretty much over-insulate the room, remove the drafts, and just go over the top if you can, because the few extra dollars you're going to spend in the beginning will mean lower energy bills. So when you cover your windows with a film that can reflect the heat in, you can use polystyrene that has silver foil on it that can reflect the heat back in as reflective insulative panels that can be in the floor, it can be in the walls. You can use all sorts of things in the walls, in the ceiling. The ceiling is extremely important if you're using regular heat to insulate so that you can keep the heat in the room. And then go and use the right kind of heating. So you don't want to use a heater that's okay for heating a room generally for winter. You want something stronger than that because you want to be able to heat the room quickly with a minimal amount of energy consumption. So make sure as well that if you want to heat the room to 105 or 100 degrees Fahrenheit, about 39 to 42 degrees centigrade, then if you want to do that, you need to make sure that you've got a heater that's not going to cut out with a thermostat at around 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's really important to do your research there. And I know on the forum at hotyogadoctor.com, you will find that there are some brands that people have actually recommended that they're using at home. So go online and have a look there. So the stronger the heater, the less time and power to heat the room. Consider infrared heating because you won't need to be so concerned about setting up a really confined space with as much insulation because of the way that the infrared heaters work. And, you know, just go and do some yoga with or without the heat. You can also, if you're really finding it hard to heat your space, just wear a little bit more clothing.
Yeah, you know, I did one time I had a good solution. I've tried a bunch of different things, you know, everything from putting tea kettles in the corner of the room to, you know, turning the shower on in a bathroom and this kind of stuff. But
a lot of people do that, Lucas. Yeah. I worry about the water bills.
Exactly. Nothing is very energy efficient here. But I lived in Hong Kong for a year, and in Hong Kong, they like to think they're a tropical country, so they don't have heat, but it gets freezing cold in the winter. So there's no central heat anywhere. Everybody's just freezing, pretending they live in the tropics, you know? But people buy space heaters. So you buy these little space heaters you can just buy in any department store. And I'm sure they're available in the West, too. I just haven't lived in the West so long. But so what I did is I went out and bought a space heater for a very big apartment, like a really strong space heater. It wasn't that big. It wasn't much bigger than a standing fan like that you'd put in a normal room, but it had the power to heat a full-size room. And then I just stuck it in a very, very small room, and that's where I practiced. And it worked. It worked pretty well. I mean, it was kind of like windy heat. You know, it was hot. You had to be kind of close to it, so you had this sort of, you know, sweltering breeze coming on you, but that was the most effective thing that I've used. And for sure, radiant heat panels are the best. They're just a little bit pricey, but there's a great company in New Zealand. They used to be called Enerjoy, and I think they've changed their name now, but they sell these radiant heat panels, which work amazingly well and are quiet and energy efficient and stuff. So for a home studio, if somebody had one of those set up, you would be the envy of all your hot yoga buddies for sure.
All right, any more questions?
Yeah, one more question. Maybe you may, it's something that I've been really interested in recently. In the past few years, there's been this huge movement from where hot yoga people are just becoming really, really interested in Anusara yoga, which, in my opinion, couldn't be more different than hot yoga in many ways. And I wonder if you have any opinion about why this is happening or where this interest is coming from and where you see kind of the future of the hot yoga movement.
Well, I know you're not really asking me to compare one kind of yoga to another. I think it's a slightly different question there because, well, the way I see it, yoga is a tool and everyone's just free to choose their own tool of choice, their own style of yoga. And as you know, I just, you know, I'm passionate about this hot yoga and love to help people feed their own passion and to get a whole lot more out of their practice, whether they're practicing or practicing and teaching. So, you know, I just get more and more questions about alignment and the way to approach poses. And people want the benefits and they want to know the basic principles on how to get them. So when it comes to Anusara yoga, which from what little I know is based on certain alignment principles, I really don't know how huge that movement is. It's really not that big here in Australia. But my guess is that it's a backlash against the haphazard way that hot yoga in general or many other styles of yoga in general can be taught and even how the teachers are trained. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree. I mean, that's what I see. Like there's a movement now in the States especially where Bikram teachers are using Anusara principles in class. And I see it as the same idea. It's this backlash of the, you got this huge body of teachers who are really hungry for a deeper understanding of their practice, and they're not finding it within their own tradition, so they're just looking to other schools. That's kind of my thought, but just as an outsider looking in.
I think people are wanting more from their yoga, and they don't know where to find it. And that's a great thing, that people want to know more, and they want to bring that into their lives and their discipline. And I think that's really what inspired me to put my manual together. And I didn't call it Anusara. I just had a look at basic alignment principles and applied that to the series to be able to make a lot more sense out of it so that anybody of any body type, of any ability, can actually extract the benefits from it by applying certain principles across the board. So I'm really not familiar at all with the Anusara method. I know there's the use of the word spiraling a lot, and I really honestly don't know that much about it. But I do know that people are looking for better tools on which to base their practice.
Sure. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think you've shared with us a lot of really great ideas, and I just want to say a big thanks to you, Gabrielle, the Hot Yoga Doctor, for joining the Yoga Body Gang today. And if you want to learn more about Gabrielle and her work, you can visit www.hotyogadoctor.com. That's where you'll find her home study kit, which I have, and it's excellent. And you can also visit her hot yoga forum, which we've talked about a few different times here on this call, where you can chat with other students, chat with Gabrielle, and also there's quite a few teachers on there sharing a lot of ideas about everything from diet and practice to, like we talked about, setting up your own kind of renegade hot yoga studio in your closet kind of thing. And you can also find that at www.hotyogadoctor.com. And with that, I think we'll just say thanks and sign off for today.
Thank you so much, Lucas. It was a pleasure talking with you again. I really hope we can do it again soon.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. Take care.
Okay, bye.